Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Before we begin, I wanted to make an announcement explaining the reason why we've had some reruns in the last couple weeks. Two reasons this is happening. One, I've noticed that two-thirds of the new Word Balloon audience has never gone to the website and may not be aware of some of my older episodes with some great guests. The second reason is I had a hard drive accident and lost a couple recent interviews, and rather than have people waiting a long time in between, I just wanted to keep things going and remind people of some of the greatest guests we've had in the past. Case in point, today's guest, Colleen Duran. From 2005, back in June, Colleen will be discussing her work on projects with Warren Ellis, some still to be released, J. Michael Straczynski, Mike Carey, and others. And she'll give us the perspective of a creator-owner nearing the wrap-up of her long-running fantasy tale, A Distant Soil. She'll also explain her views as an American artist attempting to draw and understand the ideas behind Japanese manga. As I said, the conversation took place back in June of 2005, when Colleen was just beginning her collaboration with J. Michael Straczynski on the first book for Marvel's Icon imprint, the creator-owned Book of Lost Souls.
It starts off in London in the late 19th century, around the late 1880s. A young man is in despair over lost love and rejection, and rejection from his family, and he has an artistic soul, and so on and so forth, and boo-hoo-hoo, his feels like his life is over, and he gets up on the top of this bridge ready to jump over, and some guy shows up with a great big book and says, "Here, this is nice and heavy. You'll sink faster if you hold on to this." So after that warm and fuzzy moment, he wakes up. It's the 21st century. He has drowned. And he has been saddled with this book in which it looks like his task is to now save the souls of people who were lost souls like he was, and to fill this book with their destinies. It's quite a moving book. I am just sitting here working on issue three, and issue three is especially moving for somebody like me. It involves a young artist in despair living on the streets, and it really gets to me working on this project, going from story to story in these different people's lives. I like it quite a lot.
Is it going to be an ongoing project, or is this a finite series?
It's ongoing. We'll see how it goes. I can't really conceive of a Straczynski project not doing well. I guess he's got the golden touch, and I feel like I've been anointed. You know, I'm signed on for a good period. I guess I'll be on it for at least a year. And they've pretty much given me the speech, "Please, please, 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 please don't miss a deadline. Please don't go on vacation. Please don't break anything."
So you're a slave to the project.
Yeah, I think so. I think it'd be hard to replace. I can't imagine there are too many artists out there that have some of the funky quirks, stylistic quirks that I have.
Yeah, this project sounds like it's totally in your wheelhouse when you look at things like A Distant Soil and Reign of the Zodiac. I mean, this is what you do. This is great. This has to be wonderful.
It's a little darker than either Reign of the Zodiac or Distant Soil. It's probably got more of a Sandman flavor. It's about as vertigo as Marvel has gotten thus far, but it's not cynical in the way that a lot of the Vertigo projects are. This one has a dark edge, but it's a hopeful book. One of the things I like most about Straczynski's work is the moral and ethical center of his work. And a lot of the Vertigo stuff is dystopian in nature, a little dark for me, which is funny because I like Hellblazer and Lucifer. In fact, I just did an issue of Lucifer.
Yes, I know about that. Yeah. So you worked with Mike Carey on that.
He's brilliant. Oh, man. I was dying for another chance to work with him. I hope that happens someday.
That's cool. No, that's very cool. Real quick, with the Book of Lost Souls, is each issue going to be a separate task for this, man who has the book then?
So far, I haven't read beyond issue three, so I don't know where he's going, except he set some stuff up. And I'm afraid to ask, I don't really want to know where it's going, because I'm kind of enjoying reading it as I go along. But thus far, the first few issues have been his different tasks. But the first issue is the setup. Mm-hmm. And there's some stuff set up in the first issue that makes you go, "Oh, where is this going to be 5-10 issues from now?" It's kind of cool. So I honestly don't know where everything is going to be, 5 or 10 issues from now. I'm kind of like, hey. But but I don't even want to know. I enjoy reading things as I go, and I don't want to know too far ahead. I like the surprise, and I think it keeps my work fresh. If I sit there and I mull over something for too long, I might chew it up too much.
And JMS is the kind of guy and a writer that you know from things like Babylon 5 that can really do the individual story plus the overarching theme, where when you step back, it is a much bigger story, too.
Oh, absolutely, and I was a big fan of Babylon 5. This is so embarrassing. I'm like, gosh, just such a huge Babylon 5 fangirl. And about 10 years ago, I'm at Wizard World Chicago, and I'm like, oh, my God, J. Michael Straczynski's going to be there. Wee, wee, wee. So I went to one of those big Babylon 5 get-together things. I haven't anything else to sign, so I had him sign my name badge. And I have Walter Koenig sign my name badge. And I was, like, totally geeking out. And he goes, oh, yeah. Mr. Zinski says, oh, yes, Colleen Dorna, you know, it's nice to meet you. I like your work. And I thought he was just being nice. I was like, well, it was very generous of you. And I just can't believe that 10 years ago I was getting him to sign my name badge and having my picture taken, and now I'm working with
him. That's cool. And did he say any specific project that led him to choose you for this book?
He was familiar with A Distant Soil, which was surprising to me. You know, you always think nobody's paying any attention to you, and people tell you, oh, no, I know all about that, yada, yada, yada. And there's like, me? Really? Because I'm kind of lead a pretty low-key life, and I don't get out much. Certainly not with my schedule anymore. I'm not going anywhere for the next year, but you just don't think that the people you admire are looking at you.
Sure.
You just think it's all one way, and I'm certainly that way. I'm always surprised when I find out somebody likes my stuff. If I go to a signing and people show up, I'm always surprised. I'm probably going to be surprised until the day I die. it's just a nice thing to have happen that sometimes I can't quite believe is happening to somebody like me, and I'm just really grateful. And of course, I didn't stay in touch with Straczynski for, you know, the last decade. I just said hi to him once or twice. I'm like, oh, I wonder if he remembers who I am. And then about a year ago, this was unbelievably kind. I was going through a professional problem. It was kind of public and embarrassing. And he wrote me a note out of the clear blue sky. He got my email from somewhere, and he just wrote me this note. Very kind. And I went, well, shoot, well, that was decent of him. Well, what a nice thing to do. And a number of months later, he writes again and says, you know, I've got you in mind for something. Would you be interested? I'm like, okay, where's the glass and the hot coals? Do I have to walk across them first? And then he sends me the script around Christmas, and I read it. I was like, oh, my Lord, I have to have this one. What do I have to do? And I had to audition, and another indication of just how generous and decent this man is. He's like, I feel bad about you doing any work on spec. If you don't get this job, I'll pay you for that.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, my God, you know, nobody in my entire career has ever offered. And usually you do samples for people that they're supposed to pay for them, and they don't pay for them. And I thought, holy cats, this is really amazing. And fortunately, he didn't have to do that because I got the job anyway. So it was a big relief. I know there was somebody else, I'm not going to mention their name, somebody really good up for the gig.
And you whooped him.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it.
Nice going.
Oh, I thought, well, am I going to have to murder them? Do I have to sacrifice a goat? But I didn't have to go that far. I got the job anyway, and it was a big relief. I wanted it so bad. I read that script. I said, no, man, I have to have this one. I'm so right for it. I can't remember the last time I sat down to do a book that felt so comfortable to draw. I'm always changing my style from book to book, and I've changed my style on this one.
Okay.
But it's really good for me. And the funky thing about it is in issue 2 and in issue 3, there are sequences in them in which I'm drawing in a different style from the overall story arc style.
Okay.
So because a lot of this is the psychology of the characters who are in despair, some of the things that are happening in magical places in their head, or their dreams or their mm-hmm. visions. And so when I draw the overall story arc, it's in this sort of gritty, vertigo-esque style that I often use. But in the second issue, there's a very pretty fantasy style. And then in the third issue, there are sections that are going to be drawn and shot from pencil art.
Okay.
So I don't know how long we're going to be doing that, but I'm trying to give you the different flavor of the different people's inner world. I hope that makes sense.
It does. No, okay. Absolutely.
Great.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because you compare A Distant Soil and Orbiter, and you do stretch in Reign of the Zodiac, and it's clear that you are, it sounds like you welcome these challenges from an artistic standpoint to stretch yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I love it. I love it. I think people think I'm either versatile or schizophrenic.
Don't go with versatile.
I prefer to think versatile because it's got such a nice ring to it over multiple personality disorder. But I was strongly advised against doing this my whole career. I remember meeting people like John Byrne and talking with Frank Kelly Freeze, and they said, you've got to pin yourself down to one style and just do that so that people will know you by that. And I said, no, I want to be known for being the person who can draw anything. I don't want you to come to me just because you want me to draw something that fits in this round hole. I want to be the person that is right for every job. And I'm willing to try things that I'm not even sure are right for me, because I think if you could draw, you ought to be able to draw anything.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, some things are going to be better for you than others, but I don't think you should limit yourself to one look, and I think it can not only make you work dated, but you can get comfortable and lazy, and I'm more afraid of that than anything. I would rather always be searching than feel like I've arrived, because it's not the destination, it's the journey, and I would rather just keep traveling. So for me, moving from one book to another, moving from one look to another is okay. Certainly there are stylistic things that you can look for in my work that are consistent, and I think the storytelling style is usually consistent.
Okay.
And characterization is something I spend a lot of time on. Body language, faces, getting real emotional resonance in people's faces. But I don't have any problem with drawing things in a different way or experimenting with different tools. And I understand why other people don't do it. I'm just thinking it's not the right choice for me. I need to move around.
And the Book of Lost Souls will start in September?
It's actually going to be in October.
Okay.
I think they just solicited it.
Okay.
In fact, we were pulling for September, and I just moved. And, oh, my Lord, I hope I never do that again as long as I live. That was hideous. I scheduled 2 weeks for it, and it took 2 months because I had to do renovations and all this stuff. And I was,
oh, man.
Oh, this is not funny. I don't ever want to go through this process again. So it's been a grueling spring. Everything's been about change this spring. I haven't had any stability until the last couple of weeks. So it's been exciting and scary to know that I'll be penciling and inking a monthly series.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize you'd be doing both. That's terrific.
Oh, yeah. I don't actually pencil anymore. I do these quickie little doodles.
Okay.
I don't even, you know, I email them in, and they go, yeah, that looks great. And how could they possibly know? This stuff looks like an epileptic seizure across the page. And I just ink right on top of it. I don't do that much preliminary drawing. And I find that saves a lot of time and a lot of effort, because penciling just and then inking it means you're drawing everything twice. I think that's retarded. So I prefer to just draw cleanly in ink as much as possible. And I also work very small. My original image area art is only, gosh, what is it? It's just under 8x12. So,
oh, wow.
Really tiny. And that enables me to work faster as well. I find it increases my speed from a quarter to a third.
Wow. Okay. And I was going to ask you that. Yeah. How long does it take you to? I mean, I guess it would depend on the page composition. But you know, on average, how
about a day? I'm pulling about a day. I'm actually doing lately. I've been doing a little bit more than that. I nowadays I work 7 days a week.
Wow.
But 2 days a week is like a half day.
Okay.
I just really mellow, and I might only work a couple of hours. But the rest of the week, I pull a long work day. It's going to, 10, 12 hours maybe. And on those days, I'll do over a page. And on a really good day, I might even pull 2 pages, but it's usually going to be about 1 1/3 pages. But on my off days, even though I will try to work all day, usually I'm too tired, so I just doodle in front of the TV and go, well, that was effort. But I don't like to get off the treadmill. I like to keep drawing. I like to keep moving. I take my work with me when I travel. Because it's small, you can fit it in a small portfolio, carry it on the airplane. I work on the plane. I work in the hotel room. Doesn't matter where I am, I keep going, and I don't like to stop. I don't know why, but if you stop, it's hard to get back.
No, I hear you. Let's talk about A Distant Soil.
Mm-hmm.
For people who haven't read the book, just, if you can describe the story.
Well, it's about a young girl who is in a mental institution, and you don't find out why she's there for quite some time into the story, but it turns out that she's got psychic powers. She and her brother both have psychic powers, and they're really in an institution to be exploited, not to be treated for any illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out they're half alien, and she's born with this power that makes her an avatar. And according to these alien people, an avatar is someone who has the ability to draw on the collective psychic output of everyone on their home world, and they believe that makes them a conduit for the power of God. So she's born with this power that should belong to their religious leader, only they've already got somebody sitting on that throne, and the power only works for one person at a time. If two people have it, they interfere with each other like a bad radio signal. And that makes her a threat to this world and their government. They use their avatar as a weapon. They're their ultimate secret weapon, and she's got to be gotten rid of. And it turns out the avatar who is on the throne not only doesn't like his job, would very much like to be out of it, and he's actively working against his own government to destroy them and get rid of their hold on all the worlds that they control. And it's very dramatic space opera, lots of politics and psychodrama, so goes on for just pages and pages.
it's quite the epic, and it is amazing all the themes that you're collecting together in this one ongoing story.
I think Neil Gaiman said it very kindly when he said that the young are like magpies. He wrote the introduction in my first volume, and
mm-hmm.
he was talking about how it reminds him of the great epics that all aspiring creators have in them when they get started. And he said, I had one, and Colleen had one, and the difference between Colleen and everybody else is most people's never got published.
Right. But that's true.
And mine did. And so it is a very, very strange, even for me to read it, because I'm reading these values and ideas of this wacky kid.
Of who you were.
Of who I was, and now I have to finish it, and it's all these years later. I'm not going to tell you how many years later it is, because it's getting kind of scary.
But you did start very young, Colleen.
So oh, well, yeah. Oh, really young. Worry. Oh, I was a fetus. I've actually got the fourth volume coming out. We've been struggling with the technical aspects of it, because the first one we've done entirely digitally.
Oh, wow.
Doing the scanning and everything. The original art, all my art is by hand,
mm-hmm.
but the scanning and doing everything here in-house has just been a nightmare. I've never done it before, and I'm glad I only have to learn this once. But anyway.
Now this story, because it is a personal project, and you're able to start and stop it when you need to, because,
mm-hmm.
and I've seen you in other interviews talk about the fact that sometimes you have to put it on the back burner
oh,
just
yeah.
to generate some income.
Oh, sure. And it's been really, really a funny journey because, you know, there are times when I'll spend a whole year doing nothing but a distant soil, and then the next year I can only produce one issue.
Sure.
And it's entirely a function of financing. It is a cult book. And the people that love it really, really, really love it. But it's so different from most of the material that's out there that, you know, some people are, that it's so involving. You know, it's quite a commitment to sit down and read this epic that's going on 1,000 pages now. You know, some people are reluctant to pick it up. And it was, you know, considered girly when it was first created, and people didn't want to touch it for that. Of course, now nobody says that. You know, they're like,
cool.
"Oh, it's a classic." And they're like, "Oh, that's not what you were saying a few years back, you."
Longevity breeds respect, and I think that's great, though.
Oh, I think it's really cute, but it's cracking me up. Wait a minute.
Where were you when I needed you?
Yeah, oh, no kidding. And I just found out today that there's this new series of books coming out that'll be going to libraries. It's a 3-volume series on graphic novelists, and they're featuring 75 people. And they wrote me and they said, we want you to be one of the important graphic novelists, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm thinking, man, when I was sitting there doing this thing when I was a kid, I never would have thought, all these years later, that people would be writing books about it and putting me in documentaries and crap. It just messes with your head.
Well, and I saw you in Rich Hend's Tales of the Mainstream.
Oh, isn't
and
that
Tales of the Small
hideous?
Print. No. Now, I've seen you complain about that before, and you know, it was on the spot, and you looked fine, and I thought you did great.
Well, the thing I like about it is, you know, it's real, but, you know, boy, you just think, man, where's the person who does Mariah Carey's lighting when you need her? Can I have that makeup artist and that hairdresser and that lighting technician, please?
No,
oh, man, because it was just, you know, in the living room with the spotlight. And
sure.
The thing that's not on the video, this was so funny, he starts filming. My cat walks in the room and woofs up a big old hairball. Stop, and I had to go and clean up the cat vomit.
Well, that should be a deleted scene.
I think they should have left that in. That's mainstream really raw. It was so funny. I was like, oh, my God. Because they had all the hors d'oeuvres out, nice little drinks, and everybody's having aperitifs and everything. And the next thing I know, my cat walks in there in front of all these people and yucks up a big one.
Enjoy your meal. Oh, that's great. For a distant soil and the fact that it comes out so irregularly, do you ever think about going to just occasional graphic novels as opposed to the single
issues? You know what? It wouldn't really be worth it at this point because I'm just started working on the last graphic novel.
Okay.
The story's going to be ending in about 6 or 8 issues along those lines. And the 5th volume will end this big epic storyline. And there will be a prequel, which was actually, I've actually finished about half of it. It was published in some of the early issues of A Distant Soil, but it's never been collected or finished. That I will just finish in an original graphic novel.
I see.
But I'm going to finish off the comic book series. I'm not sure how far we're going to go. You know, we're on issue 38 now. I think we'll go to about maybe 45, maybe I'll go wild and go to issue 50. That might take another 10 years, but I hope not.
No.
And that's going to be it. And, you know, I'm not going to do this thing where I hire a bunch of other people to write and draw stories and yada, yada, you know, just, ugh, I can't stand that. When it's over, it's over, and I really mean I'm not going to be doing, you know, stories every couple of years to revive the franchise because I hope somebody will make a movie. You know, I'm not interested in that. It's over. I actually cut a huge section of it, and I was sitting down with Jeff Smith on the phone one day, and I was going, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, oh, my God, it's going to take me the rest of my natural life to finish off this thing. What am I doing? And he said, well Colleen, what is it you're trying to say? I was like, oh. You're right. Why am I spinning it off and doing all these side stories and meanderings in the tale I said to Jeff, I said, you know, it's beginning to fear that I'm going to end up just doing fanfic of my own work, which is, you know, what I think has happened with properties like ElfQuest. I think they've lost their focus. You know,
okay.
Stick to the basic. What are you trying to say? Now, there's, you know, certain things like, you know, with ElfQuest, that's how they make a living. That's their franchise, yada, yada.
Certainly.
But, you know, you can't convince me that the sequel that Barry Blair did was as good as the original material.
Sure.
I don't want that to happen to my work. I just want to do and complete it and say what I'm going to say. And he said, what are you trying to say? And I said, man, that's all I needed to hear. And I got up off the phone, and I went into the other room, and I know it sounds so funny, and I looked in the mirror, and I just went, Eureka. And I came running back to the phone, and I picked up the phone, and I said, I know exactly what I'm going to do, and here's what I'm going to cut. I said, you're absolutely right. I have to keep it to its essential and say what the story is supposed to say and then walk away. Tell your story. If you're going to do anything else with it, you better be good.
Was being an artist and a writer always part of your professional plan?
It's funny. I never really had any doubts that you could write and draw comics, or even that women could write and draw comics. I'm hearing all this weird stuff from women creators going, there were no women around when I was a kid. And I'm like, that's a load of crap. I mean, there were plenty of women around. I mean,
sure.
Maurice Severin.
Absolutely.
And Ramona Fridone.
Absolutely.
And Mary Jo Duffy and Louise Simonson. And I remember when I was a kid getting the Mighty Marvel calendar. In it, they would have little pictures of Marvel creators,
mm-hmm.
and their birthdays. And there were a lot of women in there. So I was very much aware that women were in the comic book industry writing and drawing from the time I was a little girl. So I don't think these other women who are claiming there were no women around or that much older than me that wouldn't have had the same experience. So I've always found that kind of confusing. But I always knew that people could write and draw their own comics, because for me the big deal when I was a little girl was Hal Foster's Prince Valiant.
Absolutely. Great stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff.
And my big inspiration to do A Distant Soil as a big book was from those Nostalgia Press collections of Prince Valiant that were published as early as the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that was a seminal form of graphic novel.
Every one of those Sunday pages, too, are so lush and just really beautiful and would tell its own story for that week, even.
Oh, yeah. And I can't remember. I may not have been Nostalgia Press. It may have been another company. But they published these books that you could order them in elementary school. They had catalogs where you could order books like,
sure.
Scholastic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got mine. And they were hardcover with dust jacket, and they were about 130 pages. And most of them were clips from the comic with more text. But it was a early form of graphic novel. And then, of course, I saw Howard Chaykin and Samuel R. Delaney's Empire,
mm-hmm.
Which was published by Byron Price,
yes.
in the 1970s.
Who recently, unfortunately, passed away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was terrible. I mean, you know, there's so many people running around going, I create a graphic novel. I'm like, no, come on. Let's
set them straight.
Yeah, give some credit where it was due. This guy's been publishing graphic novels since I was a child, and plugging away at it and putting them out there and producing them regularly for 30 years. So, hello.
No, I agree, and I'm a huge fan of his Steranko book, Red Tide.
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah, they did great stuff. And
oh, yeah.
The Empire was a big influence on A Distant Soil.
That's cool.
It was a big influence on me. I used to keep it checked out of the library all the time. I didn't want anybody else to have it. I just... And there was a graphic novel in a library, you know, like what, like 1980 or something? I mean, that was way before all these other books that were claiming to be the first, like ElfQuest and stuff.
Sure.
That stuff predated it.
I want to talk about Orbiter, because
sure.
I it just knocked me out. And
it really changed my career. Warren Ellis, there are a couple of people that helped me out immensely over the last few years, and one of them was my agent, Spencer Beck. I almost left comics about 5 or 6 years ago, because I was like, man, you know, this is not happening for me. I'm typecast. I can't get any other work. And, you know, it's just not working out. I'm going to have to, you know, move along. And my agent said, nope, you got to stop thinking that way. I said, well, what am I going to do? I can't even get an editor to return my phone calls. He said, I'll get you into Marvel. I'll get you into DC. So he took me into New York one day and walked me from office to office with my portfolio. And that weekend, we picked up $30,000 worth of work.
Wow.
I said, wow, I think I'll come back to comics now. And, you know, he said, people just thought knew you were available. You're so isolated. I'm very gregarious when you meet me, but on a day-to-day level, I'm quite, almost reclusive. I live in a little tiny nowhere place. You know, don't socialize that much. And I'd hardly get up to New York. I hadn't been to New York in about 8 years.
Wow.
You know, I never go to see my editors. Most of them have never even met me.
Wow.
And, not a joke. I mean,
have you met Warren yet? Because I know.
No.
Okay, because I was going to ask. I mean, this was, Orbiter came out in 2003, 2 years later, and you guys still haven't met.
We have never met in our entire lives. And I don't think I've met my editors up at Marvel either. The people I'm working with, I think Axel Alonso is the editor on Lost Souls.
Okay.
He says he thinks he's met me once, but I don't remember. It's terrible. But I just don't get out that much. I just, you know, I'm pretty focused. I, you know, do what I got to do, and not really into living the life. I like doing the work, so I stay home and do my work. But, they just said, well, we'd have been hiring you. We just didn't know where you were, and we didn't know you were available. So I'm a little bit better about marketing myself than I used to be. But I still was having trouble getting the work I really wanted to do. I mean, they were giving me jobs like Power Pack, which is very cute and very nice and everything, but it's not really what I wanted to be doing.
Sure.
And when I got the job on Orbiter, oh, thank God. And I got that because I'd done some other stuff elsewhere with Warren, but not in comics. I'd done a short story for Art Bomb with Warren.
Okay.
And I think it's still up. I think you can still see it at artbomb.net. And I'd also done some conceptual work for a film that Warren was working on.
Okay.
So that's how I got the job on Orbiter. And of course, when it came out, it did really, really well and changed a lot of people's perceptions of what I was capable of doing.
It was a big splash, not only in comic books, but also in traditional book circles as well. Am I correct?
It appears to have done really well. It sold very well as a hardcover. Everybody was quite surprised. And, of course, there was that awful situation with the shuttle.
Yeah, you know, now the book was supposed to come out, unfortunately, the week of the Columbia tragedy.
Well, actually, we solicited it that week.
Okay.
The solicitation came out on Wednesday, and the Columbia blew up on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
And I was at a comic book show in Pasadena soliciting the book, and I had this big poster that was a picture of the double-page spread of the Orbiter in flames.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk in that morning, and the space shuttle just blown up. And somebody goes, oh, you just did that to capitalize on it. And I almost launched myself across the table and strangled somebody.
Sure.
But I didn't know what to do. You know, do we take it down? Do we leave it up? Do we take it down? Do we leave it up? And people said, leave it up. You know, everybody said, leave it up. Leave it up. And I said, all right. And, you know, I was literally on the last page. On the plane on the way home, and I just started crying on the plane. I'm drawing this thing, and people are staring at me, and I'm like, oh, shit. Oh, excuse me. I don't know if I can say that.
You can say anything you want, Colleen. It's the Internet.
I feel much better now. So I had to redraw the last page because I was so upset that I drew the whole shuttle just skewed at this weird angle. So when I got home, I had to redraw the entire page. So we weren't even sure the book was going to come out.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Were there any discussions between either you and Warren or you and DC or the three groups and deciding if any changes needed to be made because of the sensitivity of the subject?
What they decided was that there would be enough time between the solicitation and the tragedy and the book actually hitting the stands that it would be respectable.
Sure.
And, of course, Warren wrote that very lovely dedication
yes.
to the crew. And a good friend of mine says that he gave a copy to the commander's wife.
Wow.
And I was just like, oh, man, that's
yeah.
just beyond cool. Just, ugh. So, and then, of course, when it came out, it just, it got such a great reception. I was so proud of that book.
Well, it's a brilliant story, and it's a beautifully drawn story as well.
Well, thank you very much.
It truly is my favorite of your works. Let's talk about another Ellis project, Stealth Tribes.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds really neat, and it also sounds experimental in terms of putting a sci-fi spin on how a lot of us, I guess, download our entertainment nowadays. Can you describe it a little bit?
Oh, Stealth Tribes is a dark, dark, cynical book. And it's on the back burner for a little while because I had a hole in my schedule to finish it last year, and Warren didn't have a hole in his schedule to finish it.
Okay.
And now I don't have a hole in my schedule to finish it. So we are very close to the end. I'm not kidding. If he had about a month and a half and I had about a month and a half, it'd be done.
Okay.
So whenever I get some more script, I will squeeze it in. But we're about 30 pages from the end. And I've actually drawn the ending. I'm waiting for the middle of the book.
I gotcha.
I've got the beginning and the end, and I don't have the middle. It is really, really a dark, cynical book about the transformative nature of the new technologies that we're all involved in, breathing information
yeah.
and body modification, and what are these things doing to our heads? What kind of people are we becoming? And I cannot tell you how it ends, but I'll say this much. That's all I'm going to say. Before you decide to use yourself as a model for a protagonist in a Warren Ellis book, read the ending. Oh, my God. I can't believe I had to draw that.
And I'm glad you said that because I noticed in other interviews you said that, yeah, you decided, hey, I'd be perfect for this. And
yeah.
you found all these old photographs of yourself to use as models for the book.
Right. It's the first time I've actually gone out of my way to use myself as a model. I don't usually like it. Like, you know, it creeps me out. I don't know, other people may not have this problem, but I just as soon not look at pictures myself, especially doing some of the things I did in this book. But I said, yeah, this would be pretty cool. Yeah, I've got all these old big hair rock and roll pictures of me. And I said, man, this will come in handy. And, you know, I'm a cheap model. That's a plus.
Sure.
And it was a great, great book. God, I wish it was coming out as soon as possible. It's an amazing piece of work. I think it's Warren's best writing. It's of all the things I've ever read, it's my favorite.
Well, it's very cool. And again, if it's half as good as Orbiter, then I think you guys are going to be in pretty good shape. So
it's a completely different flavor. Orbiter is full of hope. I mean, I just love that book, and Stealth Tribes is clever. It's so sharp. It's so witty, but it's very, very dark and cynical.
Well, we look forward to it when you guys have, you know, the free time to really get it finished because...
Would mean no free time at all because we don't have any.
No,
we
clearly.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm just...
Yeah.
I sincerely hope we can get it out next year. I really do. It is... I'm not kidding. It's his best work. It's brilliant.
Did you read his Ministry in Space with Chris Weston?
Yeah, I've read part of it. I haven't been to a comic shop in ages. How's that for a confession?
No, that's cool.
But but I read the first couple of installments, but I haven't read the ending.
Okay. Well, you know, it's again. I mean, you know, hell, if I remember waiting for Dave Stevens to finish Rocketeer, so don't sweat it. Don't sweat it. See, I told you.
Yeah.
I want to get to this other stuff. First of all, your love for Tolkien, and you've been able to really contribute to in an artist's way to a lot of Tolkien-related projects and stuff. I didn't know that you were in the credits at the end of one of the DVDs.
Cool. Oh, boy. Do I have geek cred or what? I am such a big Tolkien fan, and, oh, man, this, my office is just like a shrine. It's just awful. And I have multiple editions of books, and I've just read about everything, and I love the stuff. I'm crazy about it.
And you've done a lot of art for, you know, books.
I've done some art. I've illustrated a couple of books about Tolkien, and I'm supposed to be doing a cover for one. They just contacted me and asked me to do it. It's mostly scholarly stuff or that kind of thing. People seem to like it. I'm really flattered. It's a tough crowd. and they know their stuff. They really, really know their stuff. And I think one of the reasons why my work goes over with the Tolkien crowd is they know I know my stuff. I will just rack my brains trying to find the details of the characters and the settings before I put pen to paper. I don't like to make a conceptual error. And Tolkien's very specific, but in a funky sort of way, he's quite loose in his descriptions of people, except for, you know, they're beautiful and they have black hair.
Okay.
And, you know, it's pretty much all you get, but different elves will have, you know, red hair or blonde hair or dark hair, and you got to be careful. It will mess with your head. So, and I like drawing stuff from obscure sources, you know, not necessarily from the Lord of the Rings itself, but I really like the Silmarillion, and I'll get involved in that and then spend 3 hours trying to figure out what color somebody's hair is. Really demented. I need therapy, I think.
and I'm sure you love the Jackson films, obviously.
Oh, yeah, they're really beautiful. I actually think I like the first one, though.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and it seems to, even though it was the first chapter, it really did seem to kind of stand on its own as well. And you know, the Two Towers being a middle story was really a middle story, obviously. I liked Return of the King, but yeah, I would agree with you. I think Fellowship was really the best of the three.
I think Fellowship was the best. I thought Return of the King deviated the most.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could have, it was the only one where I sat there going, I would have done this.
Wow.
And the first two, I went, I understand why you did that. That was a good decision. And the last one, I was going, I would have done this. You know, the only one where I had that reaction. But on the whole, boy, what an achievement.
Absolutely.
What a piece of work. And, you know, I've got my extended, you know, limited edition, yada, yada, yada. And I love listening to the books on CD while I'm working. It's wonderful to have them read to you by an actor with a beautiful speaking voice.
Who does do the reading?
You know, I can't remember off the top of my head.
Okay.
They're in the other room. I'll say that I was never a big fan of Tom Bombadil. Never could stand Tom Bombadil. And, you know, I'd be thinking, yeah, you're dancing and singing and your boots are yellow. That just makes you an easier to hit moving target. Thanks for the yellow boots. Can't stand it. Yet, having it read to you, you hear the music of the language and understand the oral tradition from which the material is derived, and it has a poetic quality that it doesn't have when you're just a, you know, an idiot reading it for yourself. So the only way I will get through the chapters with Tom Bombadil is having them read to me, but if I read it, I skip it.
Have you seen the teases for the Chronicles of Narnia films coming up?
Oh, yeah, I'm crazy about it. Doesn't that look great?
It does. Yeah, I wanted to know what you thought of that and what you thought of the look of what we've seen so far.
Oh, it looks beautiful. I've got a couple of friends who are working on it. I've got a friend of mine who's going to be a centaur in it.
Wow.
So I'm especially looking forward to seeing that. Especially, you know, he's a great-looking guy. I want to see him with his shirt off. My priority.
No, that's all right. You know, don't kid yourself. You know, men have the equivalent of that, and I think Jessica Alba was half the reason that a lot of men over 15 went to see Fantastic Four. So I respect that.
I'm sure it is.
And Sin City.
I was sitting there going, you know, because I'm always like flirting with Frank Miller and stuff like that. It's totally meaningless. We're just old buddies. But I was sitting there going, like, man, Frank, how can you even stand to look at me? You've been in the same room with Jessica Alba. Like, everybody else must be sloppy seconds.
See, folks, this is the internet. We get to say stuff like that. I got to underline that. That's good. Good for you. See, you're one of the boys, Colleen, and I say that in a friendly man-to-woman sort of way. And you know.
Well, I hear my testosterone level is high. I don't know. It could be, but I'm sitting there like, oh, my gosh, she doesn't even look real. And then you know she is. And it's just like, oh, man, I can't wait to see her when she's 50.
Believe me, I feel the same way about Christian Bale in American Psycho.
Oh, my God. Yeah, when they told me, when they said he was going to play Batman, I said, excellent.
Sure.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. And obviously, you did love the movie, then.
Oh, I actually have not seen the new Batman film. Okay. I'm not kidding. I have done nothing but work and move. I haven't seen any movies. I haven't been anywhere. I haven't done anything except work and move. And I get a day off next week, and I want to go into the city and just watch movies and have dinner with my family and the whole nine yards. And I'm not going to work that day. I'm just going to enjoy myself. And I want to go see Batman. I want to go see War of the Worlds. So I'm really looking forward to it. But I'd seen him in a film called Equilibrium.
Absolutely.
Which I loved. If for no other reason than Sean Bean was in it. But Christian Bale and Sean Bean in one movie. Two great tastes that taste great together. So it was a gratifying experience. I like that movie.
And quickly back to the fantasy films like Narnia and The Lord of the Rings. Do you think the fantasy film boom is having a good impact on the fantasy comic book market? Or have you not seen a change because of, you know, Lord of the Rings already coming and going?
I think it has. I think that in dark times, and we're certainly living in dark times, fantasy, escapist entertainment tends to do well. You know, people want to get away, or in some ways they would like to experience the moral questions of the day through analogy. And I think fantasy fiction does that.
Certainly.
For a lot of people, and I think that's why it's doing well.
Okay. And I want to ask also about this manga technical book that you've created.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, if you would give me the title, it's How to Draw Japanese?
It's called Girl to Girl Manga, How to Draw in All the Hottest Shoujo Styles. Title subject to change by publisher at any time. The book's not going to be out for a long time, well over a year.
Oh, okay.
And basically, my premise is that many of the how-to books on manga tend to concentrate on manga as if it's a monolithic entity in one style, and it certainly is not. Manga just means comics, for crying out loud.
Sure.
And there are many different ways to draw comics, and there's more than one style of shoujo manga. And I'm doing the book with different sections that concentrate on exactly how to achieve a different stylistic look with the same basic drawing skills. And I mean, pretty much teaching them what I do when I go from style to style and change my look.
Sure.
I have to think a certain way and develop a different set of skills. And in manga, it may be, well, in this style, the head is a circle, but in this style, the head is a triangle. And in this style, you might want to use a brush to achieve the flowing lines. In this style, you might want to use a pen. This style, the figure is based on a normal human style, elongated. But in this style, the figure is based on a, you know, strange geometrical anomaly. And I show that you how to achieve the different looks from the basic building blocks up. And it's more analytical, I think, than some of the books on manga, which pretty much approach it from a general view. And when they want to get different looks, you know, it's sort of an accident because it's, you know, one guy putting his name on a book and then hiring a bunch of other artists to do the work. And in my case, I'm one artist who says, anybody can do this. And here's how it's done, and here's how I do it. And these are the things to look for. This is how you analyze. This is how you parse things out and put them onto paper for yourself. Manga is not difficult to draw by a long shot. Most of the popular styles anywhere are not difficult to draw, and they're made that way because manga has to be drawn very, very quickly. The primary consideration in commercial manga is speed of production and being able to produce the art in a production style, the same way that animation is produced.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to Japan and we were hosted by the president of Tezuka Productions, we learned how manga techniques were created by Osamu Tezuka,
mm-hmm.
based entirely on the animation studio style. And it is made to be an assembly line process where the style can be imitated by the assistants. Some of the manga artists have as many as 25 assistants.
Wow.
And as a rule, they have about 3 to 5, you know, for lower-level artists. Very few manga artists work by themselves. Most of them have a team of people working with them. And the people that are going to produce the really popular stuff where they have to produce 100 pages or more a month are working in the studio style. And that means it's just a production system. And the purpose is to draw and produce and get results as quickly as possible. It's a potboiler. It's tough.
Sure.
And, of course, big difference for an artist like me would be, you know, I draw all my own backgrounds. I do my own technical drawing. The only thing I don't do, in fact, I do most of it anyway, is spot my blacks and lay down my Zippitone. Sometimes I hire my mom to spot my blacks and lay down my Zippitone. But usually a manga artist will have different assistants that will specialize in different things. And one person will specialize in cars and guns and technical drawing. Another person will specialize in buildings. And another person will just specialize in inking costumes. And the principal manga artist will do the sketches of the figure work and write the story, but sometimes they have ghostwriters as well. So not all manga artists work this way, but frankly, most of them do.
Wow.
And the manga art styles generally follow the animation production style. There are some artists that do everything themselves, but of course they're not producing 100 and 200 and 300 pages a month.
And it's amazing, and it is that cultural divide that I think continues to separate beyond the monolithic, you know, feeling that I think some Americans have towards manga. Do you think a storytelling in the manga style is different than, you know, I mean, it certainly is, obviously, from a cultural standpoint,
mm-hmm.
but in when you try to attempt manga, you know, beyond the technical end, is there a storytelling a theme that you have to get yourself into, a frame of mind?
Of course, it's far less compressed than the storytelling in the American style. And the American style, mm-hmm. is plot-heavy. American comic books were primarily concentrating on getting a story told in 22 pages. At least they were when I was growing up, not so much now. But you know, you got a beginning, middle, and end in 22 pages. And I don't think I've ever read a manga at a beginning, middle, and end in 22 pages. I've actually spoken with several manga artists who said, well, we actually draw the story out because we run out of plot and we need to figure out ways to draw it out because we have deadlines to meet. But you know what? There are a lot of American artists who have tips and tricks for figuring out how to meet their deadlines too. So it's not a criticism. It's a situation where the production of the work affects the creation itself. For example, I was at the World Science Fiction Convention last summer, and a couple of the science fiction artists were there giving me a hard time because they think comic book artists are all hacks and yada yada yada. And I said, Well, let me put it to you this way. Do you get a whole year to perfect a painting? I said, well, no, of course not. We've got deadlines. I said, so do we. Time is a consideration. It's part of the medium of creation. It simply works differently for my medium of creation than yours. You get a month to produce a painting. If I have a day to do a cover painting, I'm lucky. But I have to produce 22 pages of finished drawings with an average of 6 images per page every month.
Mm-hmm.
Time is part of the medium. And in Japan, time and production level is part of the medium. And it's a lucky, lucky break when under that high pressure circumstance you get something that's real quality. I actually don't think that a lot of manga is quality, but I don't think a lot of American comics are quality either. I think they're, you know, just average yutzes doing their job. And you know what? That's okay. That's the nature of the beast. They keep the...
In any field.
That's the way it is. The thing that makes me sad is that most of the manga I'm seeing imported are not, in my opinion, of the best.
Really?
Oh, no. No, a lot of the classic stuff's not getting over here. In fact, I don't like a lot of the modern manga because I don't think the storytelling is as good, as pure as it was, say, in Osamu Tezuka's day, who was a master storyteller. His stuff was just as clean as could be. Anybody can appreciate it. It's beautifully, beautifully done. The guy was a genuine master of storytelling. And the storytelling was denser in the manga that I first read. And nowadays, it seems like stuff just drags on, and they don't really have anything to say, and it's just not my thing. When I do find one that's good, I'm very happy, but it seems to me a lot of the stuff that's being imported is just being imported to nail a market share.
Okay.
But you know what? That's what publishers do. That's
sure.
their job. They're
sure.
trying to nail a market share. They're not looking at it and going, well, what's the very best manga published this month? We're only going to publish that. They don't care. They want to nail their market share, and that's their job. But
volume.
I'm only buying a couple myself.
Okay.
And most of them are, you know, I think both of them are the classic manga, some of them from the 1970s, 1980s.
Well, this has been wonderful, and I don't want to leave without acknowledging something you've got coming up at the end of August. That sounds very cool, and that's the Singapore Writers Festival that you've been invited to. So, yeah, I first of all, I appreciate the fact that we've been talking as long as we have, but please tell us about this.
Well, it's very interesting. It's a cultural festival that takes place every year or so in Singapore, and primarily concentrating on Asia, or maybe it just seems to me that it's primarily concentrating on Asia because I'm so surprised to see so many Asian authors attending. I'm like, oh my God, I'm a total rube. I know nothing about most of this stuff. But it has major importance in that region. There are prizes, and the entire country is focused on it, and it gets a lot of press. It has major sponsors into the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of sponsors. It's a multi-million-dollar event. The writer of Simply Ballroom is one of the guests from Australia,
wow.
for example. Norman Spinrad is a science fiction writer guest from the United States. Ho Chi Anderson is coming in from Canada. He's a brilliant graphic novelist. And... I'm really looking forward to it. They contacted me the other day, and they said, we'd like a quote from one of your books to put on banners throughout the city. And I said, well, shoot. That's kind of neat.
What did you choose?
Oh, I may regret it, but my favorite quote from one of my books is, hypocrisy is the necessary evil of every gentleman. Which is, you know, the terrible truth of our age.
Yeah.
You know, it's never letting them know the dress doesn't make them look fat. But that's what it's about. It's about... sacrificing objective reality on the altar of fragile egos everywhere. I used to hate not telling the truth, but life is made smoother by greased wheels of little white lies. You know, that's one train that just clickety-clacks along if it's on that track. So you don't have to rub people's noses in their imperfections. It's a good idea sometimes just not to tell the truth if it's going to hurt someone's feelings unnecessarily. So I think that's a great truth.
I like it. I like it. And I don't have the stack of Bibles in front of me to swear upon, but I will tell you that it's this is a good place to wrap up and say how much truly it was a pleasure.
What a great interview.
You see? See?
Nice conversation with Colleen Duran. Don't forget the Book of Lost Souls and many volumes of A Distant Soil available at many bookstores, both brick and mortar and online. And don't forget, lots more new interviews of Word Balloon are on the way. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks so much for listening. This is John Suntress. Make sure you visit some of our other websites online, like our MySpace page, myspace@wordballoon.com, the Comic Space page, comicspace.com/wordballoon. We're also at iTunes, Podcast Alley, Audio, Podcast Pickle, all the various podcatchers. If you are so inclined to write a review or vote for us at some of those sites, we certainly would appreciate it. And if you have any questions for me, I'm always available online. My email is john@wordballoon.com. Thanks so much for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.